So continuing with beginner's mind, Zen mind, original mind, big mind, little mind, no mind, whatever mind we've got. Of course, as we study this, we, I hope, lose our bearings. We say that when we begin the study of Zen, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. And as we move deep into the study, mountains are no longer mountains and rivers are no longer rivers. We move into this upside-down kingdom. We see some new kind of freedom. We penetrate through language, beyond and including language, to see things are not as they appear. And then as we continue our study, we see that mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. But we see that mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. So this journey to come home. Monks are often known as home leavers. And when we truly set out on the way, we leave home. We leave home to find our home. And where we find our home is exactly where we started. We know it for the first time. So this journey into the wilderness, a journey into the world where our stories break down, this is a kind of death. Melissa said the other day that we've been trying to figure out how to price the guidebook for life that we give out to exemplary students. You may be qualified for one. Several of you are in the running. Please work very hard to. But I've decided that the cost of this guidebook is your life, right? The cost of entry into this moment is your opinion, how you think it should be, as long as we hold an opinion for or against. We miss what is here. So this dying of the small self is required. And not just once. There are, of course, experiences as we walk this path that are quite amazing. Openings where for a moment we really catch the smell of food in the kitchen. Moments quite big where we suddenly realize it's been here all along, but these moments come and go. They are not the purpose of our practice. If we're chasing after wonderful experiences, we will be disappointed. More like we're learning how to appreciate what is right here as the wonderful experience. And this makes no sense to the everyday mind. But it does make sense to the heart. This wisdom of being. One of you was saying how lovely it is to read or recite these sutras we do in our sutra service. These ancient words, and how, though on one level they may be unfamiliar to some of us, the deep familiarity of a true heart meeting true heart. And that ultimately our work here is not a sectarian work, it's not believing in something, but rather an acknowledging this great mysterious and wondrous aliveness that totally undoes us, totally takes us apart, no matter how much we want to hold ourselves together, and no matter how much we want to take ourselves apart. There is the time of the Dharma, the time of the unfolding, the flow of our life. We all have our opinion, about how we're doing, how we should be doing. All of this is beside the point. In the harmony of relative and absolute, it says so clearly, do not judge by any standard. So any comparison you make to how it used to be or how you think it should be is just another expression of, we might say, this small mind, this little self. Now, the little self has many strategies to wake up, and all of them are forms of greed, anger, and ignorance. So the little self working very hard to get more of the good zazen, and trying to avoid certain states. So to me, the little self is really doing the best it can. Not bad or malicious, but just limited. So we don't have to stop it. We don't have to do anything, because this little self, of course, is included, is part of a big self, all included. So Suzuki Roshi, in the chapter The Quality of Being, which I spoke of last night, he's talking about this self and other, about you, when we say you and I. And he says, you are independent, and I am independent. Each exists in a different moment. But this does not mean we are quite different beings. We are actually one and the same being. We are the same and yet different. It is very paradoxical, but it is so. Because we are independent beings, each one of us is a complete flashing into the vast phenomenal world. When I am sitting, there is no other person. But this does not mean I ignore you. I am completely one with every existence in the phenomenal world. So when I sit, you sit. Everything sits with me. This is our zazen. When you sit, everything sits with you. So this zazen that is not a strategy to get something else, but this universal being, Zazen, we might say. When I sit, everything sits with me. We live in the world of separation. We make the world of me and everything else. This is the world that the mind creates. And in another collection of Shunryu Suzuki's talks, I think, called Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness, which is his commentary on the harmony of relative and absolute, which we read this morning. He talks about that, this inside and outside. And he says, we do not make much distinction between things that exist outside and things that exist within ourselves. You may say something exists outside of yourself. You may feel that it does, but it isn't true. When you say, there is the river is already in your mind. A hasty person may say, the river is over there. But if you think more about it, you will find that the river is in your mind as a kind of thought. That things exist outside of ourselves is dualistic, primitive, shallow understanding of things. And I certainly hope you don't have dualistic, primitive, shallow understanding of things. Not that we're biased toward one view. So this river, yes, if you you can fall in the river and drown in the river. So to say it's just in your mind kind of misses the point as well. But to begin to see that this world, the whole universe is right here. And when we sit in our Zazen, can we sit with everything? The Buddha is said that when he was born, he took steps in all the directions and then said, heaven above and earth below, I am the only one. This has always been a koan for me, a kind of troubling, because on the surface, I am the only one, heaven above and earth below, sounds so narcissistic, and part of our practice is to really get that there are other people in the world, and that everyone is not some inferior version of ourselves. Everyone, of course, is a whole universe. And when someone talks, and if you say, oh, I know how you feel, you're lying. You may know how you feel, but we can't ever really know how it is for someone else. There is this separation we were talking about last night, this two-ness that we greatly value. And as I said in the beginning, we come back to be attached to things is not yet enlightenment. To see the absolute is not yet enlightenment. So this particularness, the relative world, is something we value because it is not separate. This big mind does not appear in vast space, but in this interaction. So to value the particular and also value this great aloneness, this self and world. Dogen said that an ancient Buddha said, and it's always good to quote an ancient Buddha if you want to get some credibility for what you're saying. But he said, the entire universe is the true human body. The entire universe is the true human body. So a lovely image, but what if there's some actual truth in this? The entire universe, so the rivers and the trucks and the stars, all are this human body, and that when we go deeply and simply into our experience, we see that everything is right here. This is the sufficiency of the original mind. The phenomena and mind are not different. This is not just a metaphor, but an expression of our lived human experience. So can we sit not as the little self, but when we sit, of course, little self, big self, all the parental self, all different kinds. It's a universal party to do zazen. Each one of us honoring this life that is. Is all there is, this universal life. But again, not to be caught up in some idea of vastness. We're not sitting here trying to imagine that we are the universe. But to sit being present with the breath, present with what is right here. When I sit, the whole world sits. And we call this big mind. Daishin, magnanimous mind. Mind that is the world, that is not separate. Effortless functioning. And Uchiyama says, big mind is not a matter of meditating on some vast floating spatial dimension. Rather, it is the practice of entirely devoting your life to each and everything that you encounter, no matter what it might be. So this is our practice, to entirely devote ourselves, to give ourselves, away, to meet without reservation ourself as we appear. Everything you encounter is yourself. So this is the invitation as we sit, to sit upright with great dignity, and whatever comes, to give ourself, to receive ourself, this self-giving and self-receiving. Jiju Yuzamai. This is the self-receiving and self-fulfilling absorption of life. So whatever the weather, whatever the content, appearing as separateness appearing as a universal heart. Everything is it. So when I sit, you sit. Everything sits with me. This is our Zazen. Thank you. So please sit comfortably. What arises for you as you hear this, as you encounter these words, encounter your life? Jen?
So when I sit, all the places I've been and all the things I've done before I came to the retreat are sitting with me. and sometimes that feels like connection, and sometimes it feels like distraction.
Yeah. Well, and if we go up into thinking about it, so we can go into, oh, everything's here with me. So remember that, 3 weeks ago, and we can get lost in it. So, yes, everything is here, appearing as what's arising now, not just the thought of what happened. And it's a very subtle distinction, because the thought appears as, oh, that really happened then, but it's actually happening right now. Our whole life, all of the good things, all of the bad things, right here.
Yeah, there's a way it's here because I'm here.
Right. This is the shape of your entire life, including everything. And we were talking with the teachers the other day about how tempting it is to want to exclude things from our past and say, well, that was something that shouldn't have happened, or I shouldn't have done that. But really honoring our whole life, even the things that have hurt other people, the mistakes we've made, have been part of what got us here. So in some way, we can practice being grateful to everything in our life.
And there's another way of looking at all this too, that's similar to what you talked about the river, or I guess Suzuki talks about the river. So you look at a river, and you say, we actually have the thought, river. That's a thought, that isn't the river. And all the stuff that happened before Sashin, they're all thoughts. And they're with us as thoughts. And they certainly generate physical sensations and emotions in the present moment. And so to see them as thoughts is actually quite difficult, because they appear to be real. Like, that's a river, which is very different from, being in the water. and it's quite different sitting here and having the thoughts than it was in the past when you were actually in those situations. So it's subtle, but to pull apart, I guess our job in a way is not to stop the thinking, but also not to get too involved in it, unless we find that we've gotten involved in it and we see that. But it's more to see, oh, this is thinking, and then this is me getting involved in it, right, trying to pick it apart. And it's endless, really. I think there are thoughts that are continually grabbing at us. And I don't know, you know, the long hours of Zazen that we're doing, there must be moments for all of us when we're not here. Well, we're here. But the thoughts have kind of created a little screen. It's like we're at the movies. We're at the movies of our little minds. Just going on and on and on. And sometimes it can take the form of just the self-narrative. You know, that it gets subtler and subtler. Oh, I am not being with my thoughts right now. Alarm bell should go off. Right? There it is again. Anytime we say anything like that. So on and on and on we go. Great description of something, though, that's very common for all of us.
Holly.
While I was listening to your talk of, you know, everything sitting with me and being one with everything, I was thinking of Cosmos. I was thinking of the show that I loved as a child, and wondering, you know, why do I love stories like that, you know? Mm. And I you know, and I was thinking of the awe that I felt and the wonder, and realized that my life is worthy of that kind of awe and wonder, but it's not always going to be that kind of awe and wonder, you know? Mm. It's like sometimes I kind of want that awe and wonder, you know? But instead I have wank, wank. Like now. Maybe not that much wank, wank.
Yeah. So, how wonderful to have this awe and wonder, right? It comes up for us, and the whole universe in these moments seems so exquisite. And then, of course, we want more of those moments, right? How lovely that would be. But as you point out, a lot of the time isn't like that, right? It's the wah, wah. And so what if, you know, this same thing that expresses itself as, you know, wonder and mystery and delight also expresses itself in the form of
copyright Holly Dobbs.
And it's this you know, not being able to accept what's actually here, you know, in the form of the thing that we don't like, that keeps us from seeing the bigger picture of the whole cosmos, the whole universe, all presenting itself to us, right? And this is the entry point, right in the middle of
I think there comes a moment in practice for all of us when the went it becomes marvelous and awesome, right? Isn't that wonderful? I have to restrain myself. I've been criticized for this for years. When somebody says to me, oh, you know, I really feel so terrible about this thing that just happened, or I'm having all this pain or suffering, and I'm really with it. And I said, wonderful. And what I mean is, you're seeing this. You're actually seeing it. You're not dismissing it. You're not setting it aside. This isn't worthy. Because how many times have we done that to ourselves? This isn't worthy. Oh, but I did something good today, so now maybe I'm an okay person. Oh, then we have to be very careful because we're going to fuck up again. What if it all was this?
Yeah.
Well, and I'm so caught by the, you know, maybe I am worthy of the same wonder and awe. Like, because it's, I think for a lot of us, it's easier to, appreciate other people
or other things, you'll say, oh my God, the, you know, wow, what a beautiful way to put it. Oh, I wish I could be that articulate. Dogen talks about turning the light within. What if we turn that beam, right, that's so easily, like, wow, because we know that place of wonder, and what if we bring a little bit of that when we sit, that worthiness. So this is really sitting upright, so we don't just sit, you know, we sit manifesting our heart, you know, we sit with great wonder, and we are the universe universing.
And you know, really, and I know you'll understand this, Holly, this is one reason why we put so much emphasis on the posture, because it allows us to have our whole life. So I can be sitting upright and present and inside feel like shit, and that allows me to feel what shit feels like instead of giving into it. It's a little bit like giving into the thoughts. I can give into these states, right? But if I don't give in, then I get to experience it fully.
It shit.
Feels like shit.
Right here.
Yeah. Yes. Living the life.
I gotta say that it's very hard to maintain it when our body is upright. We kind of see through it. It's ridiculous. And we see how we're so attached. There I go again. Yeah, it's ridiculous. And yet, it's human life.
Yeah, and
in the Greek tragedies where they have a chorus and these people murder each other, one of the words that the chorus mouths is limono. Effectively, woe is me. And so we can practice, if we notice, a limono, to have pity on ourselves.
Yeah. Well, so I go two places with that. One is really compassion for ourselves. This is so hard. It's so terrifying. The habit force is so strong. So if we don't get it just right, if we're not sitting like we're supposed to, or, you know, so important to have this compassion. And then the other way is to sit upright in the middle of woe is me. Right? And feeling that, being totally undone by it as we sit upright in the middle of it. Yeah.
And it's the chorus that says that, right? It's the chorus that says that. Yes. It's not the actors who've just done all these things,
no.
Which is the other part of this whole thing. It's not personal. That's one thing that's great. All the Greek tragedies, the plays have choruses commenting on stuff,
yeah.
Right? And they're like outer representations of our inner commentary. And it's so important that they are outer, that they come from the chorus. Right? So we're all going, woe is me, together. Don't try to think about it too hard. I can see where you're going from your position.
Yeah. Yeah.
Screwing up my face.
Thanks. Esther.
So, I'm not quite sure if the mark means the same thing in my language.
How would you say it in Danish?
What is it in Danish?
What's the Danish? Well, I guess there isn't the sound that if you err, like if you're sort of like a red light in a computer game or something. Mm-hmm. That goes, wrong path,
yeah.
Or wrong direction.
Could be, yeah.
Could be. Well, what does it mean in English?
Yeah, that's what it means.
Okay. So what comes up for me is, for some reason, I think of very recently where I was at a whole day in stillness, and I came home and I felt very much at peace, and I walked into the house, and then I can't remember what it was. It was a very small thing. It just completely changed my mood around instantly. And I was up under the roof, as we say in our... and so there was... when I saw that happening. And very closely to that, and that's what is my experience often. Right after that, there was a sense of awe. I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And an openness, and maybe that infinite possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Arose, and I could do something different, or just not do anything. So the shifting of to awe and wonder, it's very delicate and constantly.
Well, and I think it's what Steve was saying too about that very reactivity or that very place. It is universal nature expressing itself. There is not a problem with being reactive. And I guarantee every one of you will be reactive until your last breath. We all will. The Buddha, the teaching is that the Buddha, even after he had his great big, you know, the ultimate big one, that he still suffered when he saw his country at war and people being hurt. So reactivity is natural. And if our goal is to cut that off, we're in trouble. But if our goal is to be aware, we can feel the fire. We're up on the roof, and we can know I'm up on the roof. And then there's freedom. Oh, now what do I do here?
Yeah. I mean, I come to see it as waking me up.
It, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
That's right. It's big self appearing as little self to wake us up. Yeah. And sometimes we think, oh, you know, this work is so hard and it requires such energy. But there is free energy available at every moment. That energy came, you did not have to work to be upset. Oh, I better, like, just whoosh, filled with energy, better than a cup of coffee. As we see it, as we can be present to it, then it transforms by itself. You don't have to do anything with it. That moment of seeing and being seen is that awakening.
And there, you know, in the four vows that we chant a few times a day, there's the line about Dharma gates. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Yeah. I've learned so many translations, but that's our current one, right? And the teaching is that every single thing that arises is a Dharma gate. So the and the are both, and the subtle turn, all three of those things are Dharma gates, the entry point to this wonderful world of ordinariness. You know, even if there are no cherries in your fruit, that's still special, right? There's something special about everything, and yet completely ordinary. And the other thing it calls to mind during the meal chant, we keep saying, we offer this to the beings in the six worlds. So, you know, one of the six worlds is the realm of the gods. And often at retreat, we enter the realm of the gods. If you haven't entered it yet, it's not a problem, because being in the realm of the gods can be a problem, where everything really is wonderful. But there is this little edge of fear behind it, because at any moment it could be disturbed. And so we say that that we can't wake up to reality in the realm of the gods. Only in the human realm can we wake up, where we're thoroughly, thoroughly, thoroughly human, where really the awe and the and the little turn and all the different kinds of things that we encounter are all equally Dharma gates. So in the realm of the gods, there is this subtle fear. In the realm of the humans, we're always trying to figure out what's going on. And the teaching is that only in the human realm can we wake up. So to be thoroughly human, this is our teaching.
So just to continue the want-want theme, right, which I love, and I was listening, and I think it was toward the end of your talk where you were talking about something along the lines of, you know, our work is to give our whole selves, to this, right? Mm-hmm. And I've had similar experiences that similar to what Esther was talking about, where I do see it, and then sometimes I get that choiceful moment of maybe this going a different route, right? But I also have times when the want doesn't stop.
Right.
You know, it just keeps coming. You know, and it's like, okay, enough already. You know, but it says, you know, so I which is it too? And so when you talked about, like, so we give our whole selves to it, it's like, yeah, and we do, and I do, and that doesn't make the universe appear differently. It might, but the want sometimes just keeps coming,
yeah.
Right? And even when I look really closely, I see that the want seems the same, but there are little differences to it moment by moment, right? But it's so important for me to meet that want, keep, like it just keeps, you know, work just keeps coming, right? And there's no trick to making this reservoir of infinite possibilities change. Right. I can't. Because it can sound like, yeah, so if we just need it and we're, you know, we're truly in the, you know, that it will transform. And it, my mind finishes that sentence with, and it will transform into something better than what's here right now, which is this, which I don't like.
Yeah.
Right? And maybe it will, and maybe it won't. I don't know what it's going to transform into. I really don't. No,
right.
The mind will try to finish the sentence.
Yes,
and that's where I can get really stuck because I it's this mind of knowing. No, yeah, I know what this is. You know, I don't know what the universe in us is going to do.
Right.
I don't know how it's going to look or feel or anything. So, anyway, just wanted to give voice to that.
I'm so glad you did. I mean that this is the that. Wish for things to transform into something wonderful is the near enemy, we say, of being aware. It's a secret practice. We're hoping that if we practice correctly, all our troubles will be gone.
Yeah.
And that would be mean that we'd have to chop up little parts of ourselves in the world and put them away in boxes.
Been there, done that.
Yeah, right. We have, and we do. And so I love to, there's so much in what you said, Laura, the importance of not knowing. So none of this is a trick, right? Truly not knowing is not a trick. And being with things as they are is not a trick in order to get to some other place. But the thing is, things are always transforming. And so we can't know how they'll transform. And this meeting, I really want to say that the meeting that we have to do and the upright position, that's it. Right, then the world meets us. We're setting up conditions for the world to meet us. It's delusion, as Dogen says, to think that we're going out to meet the things of the world. But if we set up these conditions, the 10,000 things come and offer themselves to us. And they're doing it all the time anyway, we just don't know it. We're so busy trying to figure this stuff out because we're human.
Thank you. And it can be so excruciating to sit upright in the midst of these, I call them emotional storms of just, you know, or wah-wah or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
You know, and it's this this devotion, this what's the, it's this deep intention to sit in the middle of whatever is here. It's quite something.
Yeah.
And so lovely what you said, you know, this willingness to sit in the middle of whatever is appearing, you know, that exactly how it's appearing is this thing, you know, that we have the devotion to. You know, I was thinking, so in another sense, we are always fully meeting our life, right? That it's inescapable, you know? It's just that sometimes it shows up in these forms of small self, you know, this greed, anger, and ignorance. And even that, as David pointed out, is just, you know, this small self trying to do the best that it can.
Yeah.
Right? It's so sweet, really, when you look into it, right? It just wants things to be better, and it's just that all its strategies involve greed, anger, and ignorance. You know, I want more, please,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so we're meeting our life in all moments. Mm. It's just that we have this deep belief that how it's showing up is unacceptable. This moment is not acceptable. I'm sorry. I need to change it. Right? And we're so convinced of that. Right? And this sitting upright is just, yeah, even though I hate it, right, I'm just going to not do anything about it. I'm just going to be present to it. And that is the whole thing, you know. He talks about how, you know, it's not that we turn towards our experience, and if we're good and we do that, then we receive some wonderful experience of enlightenment, right? That actually it's the turning towards our experience and dropping this idea of unacceptability is the thing itself. Right? And it's and how it shows up is constantly changing from one thing into another, you know. And our work is just to meet it all.
And I guarantee that if you turn toward your experience as it is, you will receive a gift beyond measure. without a doubt. Yeah. Lona, you go.
I have a question on ending all delusions.
Mm-hmm.
The second vow, I vow to end all delusions.
Yeah.
Like when everything is it, and then we're also doing something, or that's my experience, like, is it? It's not cutting off the thoughts, even though the thoughts are selfless and anger, hatred, and delusions. But is it sitting, or?
Well, the four vows are really koans,
uh-huh,
because they're impossible.
Uh-huh.
Right? We're going to save all beings,
uh-huh,
end all delusions, and go through all the Dharma gates and be the Buddha.
Uh-huh.
That's fine. And then I'm going to have lunch. should be easy. Yeah, I'm about to.
Yeah.
Right. So it's very hard to put this stuff in words.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's why we have the sutras and the traditional teachings and the koans, because those are ways to find language for it. And it's very fluid language, because our minds tend to be very concrete.
Mm-hmm.
Many of us have, some of us have more concrete minds than others,
mm-hmm,
but all of us do pretty well with concrete mind. And so the idea that, and this is that near enemy thing, if we just sit with things, meet everything, and as Steve just said, we're constantly meeting everything.
Mm-hmm.
We don't even have to do that. So if the little mind, you know, of concreteness says, if I do all this, then everything will be fine. And we're saying, no, just sit with everything and see what happens, as Laura was saying. We don't know what's going to happen. And we actually have to do something,
yeah.
Right? And it's a little bit like what Jenny brought up right at the beginning. You know, there are all these thoughts, and she could, as we say, go down the mind road. That's one of the things. Woman uses that phrase in the Gateless Gate. Go down the, cut off the mind road. He doesn't mean stop thoughts, but he says, watch yourself going down the mind road And there is the possibility of catching yourself. And that's what Esther was saying, that little turn. That actually happens over and over and over and over again. So the delusion might be that we can, when we make that turn, we'll never go down the mind road again. The thing is, we'll go down the mind road for the rest of our lives. But anywhere along the road that we can catch ourselves, even, you know, from Boston to San Francisco, we get to say, oh, I've been going down the mind road. Or right away. Doesn't matter. But so we actually are not doing anything, and we're doing everything. Mm-hmm. And both things are happening. So eventually, greed, anger, and ignorance, which is what that vow is referring to, and some of the translations actually name them, arise endlessly. That's one of the translations. They arise endlessly. And getting to know them allows them to transform. And that really happens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we take a vow as a bodhisattvas. Those are the bodhisattva vows in the Mahayana. We're not just doing this for ourselves. Right? The original teachings of Buddhism are that you work on your own awakening. Here, in the Mahayana, the bodhisattva ideal is that we're never going to get to perfect and complete enlightenment. So in the meantime, we practice being awakened beings. And we do this for the sake of everyone. So it's much more... there's a subtler quality to it. It's very hard for the mind to align with that.
So let's investigate this subtle quality.